Welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 25th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Waterloo Fire Chief Announces Retirement. Waterloo's fire chief will step down at the end of the year. Pat Treloar announced he plans to retire after 25 years with the Waterloo Fire Rescue. He has been the department's chief for more than a decade. I think the department is in a good spot because of the command staff and all of our members that are working together for the citizens. Treloar, the fourth longest-serving chief in the fire department's history, said Friday. I'd like to thank the former fire chief, Frank Magsman, for taking a shot and hiring a guy from Canada, and former mayor Buck Clark for taking a chance and promoting a young captain to the position of chief, he said. Among his accomplishments, Treloar lists updating the department's ambulance service. I think we are one of the better services as far as equipment and personnel. We've added ventilators, we've added scopes for intubation. Those are fairly advanced at the paramedic level, Treloar said. The department also added the position of Emergency Medical Services Training Officer, which will provide one-on-one specialized training for the department's paramedic staff and related medical trainings for firefighters. Treloar also reestablished a training captain position to oversee operations at the Regional Training Center, which offers education to surrounding departments and coordinates ongoing training for Waterloo firefighters. The training captain position has been phased out during a restructuring that took place before he was chief. Both the EMS training officer and the training captain positions started in July. An effort to address the risk of cancer for fire department staff is another area that has seen growth under Treloar. There have been a few members recently with job-related cancer that have heightened our awareness that we need to do a better job of cancer prevention, Treloar said. The profession runs the risk from carcinogenic debris picked up from fighting fires that coats protective clothing and other gear. Waterloo Fire Rescue added extractors, machines to wash protective coats and pants, and the department will be issuing a second set of bunker gear to each firefighter, allowing them to change into clean gear after a fire. Also under Treloar's watch, the city's ISO rating went from a 3 to a 2. The rating is on a scale of 1 through 10, with 1 being the best. The score can be used to calculate the price of property insurance. Treloar said that he credits the accomplishments of cooperation and support from the mayor, city council, and community. The outgoing fire chief said that he hoped to add a fourth frontline ambulance for the city. Waterloo currently has 3 ambulances staffed around the clock, and the department has 2 others that can be put into service as needed by pulling firefighters from fire stations. In the future, he would like to see the fire department receive accreditation through the Center for Public Safety Excellence. Born in Texas to Canadian parents, Treloar moved to Canada with his family when he was 5 years old. He held a position with the fire commissioner staff for Manitoba province before being hired by Waterloo Fire Rescue in 1997. He served as a firefighter, medic, engineer, and community service director, and worked his way up to captain before Mayor Buck Clark appointed him to lead the department in 2011. In his retirement, Treloar plans to spend more time with his family. Now let's go on to a more national article. QAnon follower who chased officer convicted in January 6th trial. An Iowa man who was convicted Friday of charges that he led a crowd of rioters in chasing a U.S. Capitol police officer up a staircase and accosting other officers guarding the Senate, one of the most harrowing scenes from the mob's attack that day. A federal jury deliberated for roughly 4 hours before the convicting Douglas Jensen of felony charges that he obstructed Congress from certifying the Electoral College vote on January 6, 2021, and that he assaulted or interfered with police officers during the siege. Jensen was convicted on all counts, including a charge that he engaged in disorderly conduct inside the Capitol while carrying a folding knife in his pocket. During the trial's closing arguments, the prosecutor accused Jensen of weaponizing rioters by taking the lead in chasing Capitol Police officer Eugene Goodman up a staircase. A reporter's video of the confrontation went viral. The defendant wasn't just leading the mob, he was weaponizing it, Assistant U.S. Attorney Hava Murrell told jurors. He knew he had the numbers, and he was willing to use them. Jensen, a construction worker from Des Moines, was wearing a t-shirt with a large Q expressing his adherence to the QAnon conspiracy theory. One of the most memorable images from the January 6th attack captured Jensen with his arms extended as he confronted a line of police officers near the Senate chambers. "Go arrest the vice president," Jensen told one of the officers, according to the prosecutors. QAnon has centered on the baseless belief that former President Donald Trump was secretly fighting a Satan-worshipping cabal of deep state enemies, prominent Democrats, and Hollywood elites. Jensen believed the conspiracy theory's apocalyptic prophecy that the storm was coming and would usher in mass arrests and executions of Trump's foes, including Vice President Mike Pence. Pence was presiding over the Senate on January 6th, as a joint session of Congress was convened to certify President Joe Biden's 2020 electoral victory. Before the riot, Trump and his allies spread the falsehoods that Pence somehow could have overturned the election results. After scaling the outer walls of the Capitol, Jensen climbed through a broken window to enter the building. Prosecutors said that Jensen learned from a friend's text message that Pence was about to certify the election results. "That's all about to change," Jensen replied. Jensen didn't testify at his trial, which started Tuesday. Goodman was a key witness for prosecutors. Before running upstairs, Goodman approached Jensen and other rioters with his hands on his gun. Fearing for his life, Goodman retreated upstairs and found backup from other officers guarding an entrance to the Senate, where senators were being evacuated, according to prosecutors. At least 880 people have been charged with Capitol riot-related federal crimes. About 400 of them have pleaded guilty. Juries have convicted eight Capitol riot defendants after trials, and none of the defendants who had jury trials were acquitted of any charges. Sentences for the rioters have ranged from probation for Iowa-level misdemeanor offenses to 10 years in prison for a man who used a metal flagpole to assault an officer. Now let's move on to another article. A growing problem. Nation battles childhood obesity as one in five kids struggle with the epidemic. An epidemic largely tied to poor eating and exercise habits is affecting one in five U.S. children and sending many of those youth on the pathway to future health problems and even premature death, federal data and U.S. health officials conclude. As September marks National Childhood Obesity Month, our country continues to grapple with an issue exacerbated by the aftereffects of overeating during pandemic isolation. The most recently available data from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows that about 19.7% of adolescents aged 2 to 19 years in 2017 to 2021 were classified as obese. In all, about 14.7 million children throughout the nation suffered from obesity during that time period, the CDC concludes. In a separate sampling, the CDC estimates that in 2019, 15.5% of children in grades 9 through 12 struggled with obesity. In that same sampling, childhood obesity was most prevalent in Mississippi, where 23.4% of children in grades 9 through 12 were categorized as obese. The ramifications of the issue could be dire, particularly if the problem isn't stemmed among youth and is allowed to continue into adulthood. Obesity is linked to a number of serious health concerns, including high blood pressure, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, chronic breathing problems, joint problems, and heart disease, the current number one killer in the country. Here's a subheader in the article, says The Factors. Health experts across the nation agree that COVID-19 pandemic only worsened the issue. We saw unprecedented levels of weight gain in children, specifically in the first 6 to 9 months of lockdown in 2020. Dr. Kavitha Selvaraj, medical director for the Wellness and Weight Management Program at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. Selvaraj is also a certified member of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. Generally, dramatic weight gain in children has slowed down in the past 6 to 12 months, Salvaraj said. But some of that metabolic damage that happened with new diagnoses in children of type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, and heart concerns, that's irreversible damage that occurred to children's physical health, not just mental health. That doesn't just go away when business opens back up, Selvaraj said. Several factors contribute to childhood obesity, including genetics and behavior. But medical experts agree that a lack of access to nutritious food in certain areas of the country and an intense stigma surrounding being overweight are making matters even worse. It's an insidious problem with roots in a variety of causes, and experts say solutions, both within the home and the government level, are not easily reached. We as a society need to support people and families to be able to live the lives that prioritize health, Selvaraj said. Another subheader of the article, moving on to the response. Former First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Let's Move campaign in 2010 with the goal to end childhood obesity. President Donald Trump's administration later rolled it back, disregarding rules for vegetables and fruit serving size requirements in school lunches. President Joe Biden announced earlier this year that his administration plans to host a conference to address efforts towards ending hunger, improving nutrition and physical activity, reducing diet-related disease, and closing the disparities around them. The conference, slated for September 28th, will be the first of its kind in over 50 years. Hunger, diet-related disease, and other disparities surrounding them impact millions of Americans, and the COVID-19 pandemic put a spotlight on the urgency of addressing these issues, said Susan Rice, the president's advisor for domestic policy. No one should have to wonder where their next meal will come from. Now on to another subheader, food insecurity and access. Healthcare providers across the nation say one of the biggest obstacles in preventing obesity is the lack of access to affordable, healthy food options. Experts say the problem disproportionately affects minority communities. We know that some groups tend to have higher rates of obesity related to socioeconomic disadvantage and a system barriers related to injustices and racism and different forms of discrimination, Selvaraj said. From 2017 to 2021, obesity prevalence was 26.2% among Hispanic children ages 2 to 19, 24.8% among Black children, 16.6% among white children, and 9% among Asian children, according to the CDC. Felicia Anderson, as the regional educator for the Lincoln University Cooperative Extension in Sikeston, Missouri, has been serving the southeast corner of the state, known as the Boot Heel, with some of the highest rates of poverty and poorest health outcomes for 20 years. As a whole, 18.4% of Missouri children in grades 9 through 12 were estimated to be suffering from obesity in 2019, compared to a national percentage of 15.5%. Anderson said that she has always made exercise and nutrition a priority in her programs. While she sees her students starting to carry around a water bottle instead of getting a soda and grabbing an apple instead of chips, the biggest challenge remains eating healthy at home, she said. Many families don't know how to make enjoyable, healthy food or aren't able to spend the money to do so. There's a lot of options for nutritious cooking classes or how to eat healthy on a budget in the rural area, Anderson said. We just have to educate our parents. Families in low-income urban centers and rural areas may find themselves living in food deserts, a designation assigned by the distance from a grocery store. Limited access to a supermarket makes it harder for some families to access healthy food. Now another subheader, food culture. In Alabama, where in 2019, 17.2% of youth in grades 9 through 12 were estimated to be struggling with obesity, pediatrician Dr. Richard Glaze noted that regional dietary staples of fried foods and sweet tea pose a unique issue. What you'll also find here in the South is that we love to eat. We eat stuff that oftentimes isn't good for us, and that's often generations of those kinds of choices, said Glaze, who works at the Pediatric Clinic LLC, with offices in Auburn and Opelika. Food is an important part of our lives. It's a part of our celebrations. It's a part of our family time together, and we don't want to demonize food in general. But we want to make sure we give it its proper place, he said. Sugary drinks also contribute to the obesity problem in North Carolina, according to Dr. Suzanne Lazorik, a professor of pediatrics and public health at East Carolina University. We sometimes have 3 to 5 year old children that are drinking 1,400 calories a day from beverages, which is more than whatever what even to their total calories should be from all of their nutrition, Lazorik said. Another subheader, the stigma. If the causes are complex, treatment is even more difficult. It's why doctors, public health officials, and nutritionists across the country are increasingly focusing on youth to prevent the obesity epidemic among children and adults from growing worse. One hurdle has been stigma, experts and parents say. Many people see obesity not as an illness, but as evidence of moral failing, the result of laziness or lack of willpower. As a result, many youth feel shame about having obesity. The shame can keep them from socializing, dating, putting on exercise clothes or bathing suits, and participating in classroom and extracurricular activities. Many take cover and comfort in food. It's the culture that we live in, where there's so much shaming and people saying that you're fat, you're bad. We have to look a little deeper, said Jessica Jones, a youth pastor in Lawrenceville, Virginia, a community of about 1,400 just north of the North Carolina border. Her church, Tabernacle of Zion, has partnered with a program at Virginia Tech to address childhood obesity through building community support, which research suggests is crucial to success. If you look a little deeper, there's often something more going on, Jones said. Sometimes there's trauma attached. From her practice in one of the nation's premier children's hospitals in Chicago, Selvaraj agrees. There is absolutely massive weight stigma in our society, Selvaraj said. The way we treat children and adults who have high weight is really shameful. We really value in our society a certain type of body. And when people do not meet a certain societal ideal of children, young children feel that shame. Weight-related bullying only worsens the situation, Selvaraj said. Children internalize what is said to them by classmates, parents, siblings, and others. They can actually start having a negative voice in their head where they're telling themselves that they're bad, Selvaraj said. This can lead to depression, anxiety, and eating disorders. We see an unfortunate number of eating disorders, which kind of gets missed in the patients with elevated weight, she said. People think that elevated weight and eating disorders are two separate categories when there is actually a massive overlap. And now onto the final subheader, planting seeds of change. Shoveling compost, tearing out old vegetable plants, and assembling a new garden bed, a group of 7th and 8th graders at Redwood Middle School spent part of a recent afternoon working in the campus garden. The students were getting ready to grow new food and hopefully healthy food habits. Redwood's garden is one of the ways Napa Valley United School District in California is exploring different ways to integrate gardens and garden-based nutrition into its curriculum. Similar initiatives are taking place in Nebraska. In the 2021-2022 school year, schools across the state spent more than $3 million on locally provided dairy, meat, and fruits and vegetables. That includes more than 1,840 pounds of broccoli, 66,000 cobs of corn, 107,000 pounds of chicken and millions of milk cartons. Sarah Smith, the farm-to-school coordinator at the Nebraska Department of Education, said that recent policy victories have led to increased interest in the program. In 2021, the Nebraska legislature passed the Farm to School Act, which allocated funding and created Smith's full-time position within the NDE to coordinate farm-to-school programs. There are public health and food security benefits, as well as lifelong health benefits when farm-to-school is in the picture, Smith said. Dr. Amy Christensen is the medical director of Healthy Kids U Clinic of OSF Children's Hospital of Illinois. Healthy Kids U is a weight management clinic in Peoria that partners with children and families to make healthy lifestyle choices and to prevent the main the manage to prevent and manage children with obesity-related problems. We want them to have a great healthy relationship with food and to be able to nourish their bodies so their bodies are strong and healthy all their lives, said Christensen. Empowering parents and guardians to help their children in making healthy lifestyle choices is also a key component to preventing obesity rates from climbing. It's the work you do every single day, which is not always appreciated in the moment, but pays off over time, we hope, Selvaraj said. Now on to a similar article. In Iowa, focus on nutrition and environmental factors. When working with obese children, nutrition is the first place to start, according to Stacy Milani, a pediatric physician at a Mercy One pediatric clinic in Pleasant Hill. Milani is working on her certification as an obesity medicine physician. She is experienced with patients dealing with negative health outcomes related to obesity. For younger children, getting the parents on board to work on health behaviors is sometimes difficult. It's always a bit of an issue on whether or not the parent is even going to accept that there is a problem, she said. Obviously, with children, it's got to be the parent that decides something needs to be done and to make the changes. Working with parents to manage a child's nutrition can be difficult because pediatricians don't see patients in a small window of time that doesn't allow for detailed discussions. Insurance companies often won't pay for nutritionist consultations, Milani said. Obesity in children can lead to a host of health problems, including high blood pressure, early heart problems, and type 2 diabetes, she said. As of 2019, Iowa's childhood obesity rate is slightly above the national average. Among high school students, the state's obesity rating is 17%, compared with a nationwide 15.5%, according to data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Among children aged 10 to 17, 16.9% are obese, according to the State of Childhood Obesity. Iowa ranks 18th among the 50 states for that age group. The rate in Iowa, as measured by the CDC, has increased in the past decade. The obesity rate was 13.2% in 2011 and is 15.3% in 2017. Now on to a subheader in this article, State Initiatives. Iowa has several initiatives addressing nutrition, fitness, and food insecurity aimed at reducing obesity among children. One of the most prominent is 5210 Healthy Choices Count. The program, with origins in Maine, came to Iowa in 2016 as the Central Iowa Healthy Kids Coalition sought to create simple messaging. Now the program is promoted by the Iowa Department of Public Health, the Healthiest State Initiative, and dozens of nonprofit and schools throughout the state. The campaign encourages kids to follow four easy guidelines: eat 5 servings of fruits or vegetables in a day, use screens for no more than 2 hours a day, engage in physical activity for 1 hour a day, and consume 0 sugar-sweetened beverages. It is based on proven ways to improve health and reduce obesity. Healthiest State Executive Director Jamie Haberler said, "The Healthiest State Initiative is a nonprofit with the goal of making Iowa the healthiest state in the nation. 5210 is evidence-based," she said. We know that Iowans aren't eating enough fruits and vegetables, and this is for kids as well as adults. The program has sites in schools, workplaces, and childcare centers in 83 Iowa counties. For the past 3 years, the state has given grants to 16 communities for childhood obesity prevention to create sustainable, equitable, environmental, and policy changes that support active living and healthy eating, according to a 2021 report. 5 more Iowa cities will begin receiving funding in 2022. Working together, Iowa Department of Health and Human Services and the Healthiest State Initiative provide strategic leadership, stakeholder engagement, community funding, and evaluation to the initiative, Iowa HHS spokesperson Sarah Ekstrand said. When it comes to making healthy choices, how Iowa stacks up with the rest of the nation depends on the metrics. In the 2019, according to the CDC's High School Youth Risk Behavior Survey, Iowa students scored lower than their national peers on most nutrition metrics. They were more likely to not have eaten fruits or vegetables in the last 7 days and to have drank soda or multiple servings of soda in a day. On physical activity metrics, Iowa students mostly fared better than national averages. They were more likely to have participated in a physical activity for at least 60 minutes or a single or multiple days in the week. They were also less likely to have played video games or used a computer 3 or more hours a day, less likely to not have attended physical education classes on 1 or multiple days. Now onto another subheader, federal assistance. Like other states, Iowa participates in federal programs providing nutrition assistance to low-income families and children. Iowa's obesity rate for 2 to 4 year olds participating in WIC, a federal nutrition assistance program for women, infants, and children, was 15.8% in 2020, according to the CDC. In 2019, 58,064 Iowa residents were enrolled in WIC, according to a report from the State of Childhood Obesity. The report found that 46.8% of residents eligible for the assistance participated in 2016. The state also administers the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, with 144,000 children participating in 2018, or 43.4% of those eligible. The Healthiest State Initiative also offers a Double Up Food Bucks program that allows SNAP recipients to increase the buying power of their assistants on fresh produce at participating stores. SNAP recipients can get up to an extra $10 a day to put towards produce. They can go to a participating location, whether it be farmer's market or grocery store, and they can use their SNAP EBT card to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, and for every fresh fruit and vegetable they purchase, they can receive a dollar of Double Up Food Bucks, Haberl said. Onto another subheader, social environmental factors. When looking at the causes of childhood obesity, Jessica Nelson, United Way Community Impact Coordinator for Health, said it helps to understand the social determinants of children's health, including environmental factors. Nelson said obesity rates are about more than just eating healthy foods and being active. The prevalence of childhood obesity also depends on the environment children live in. The prevalence of sidewalks, green space, and food availability in a neighborhood are all correlated to health and obesity. Such things can be changed through policy changes, but not necessarily individual actions. How can we make sure folks that understand the importance of that, and it's not just about making those healthy choices and choosing apple over chips, but really, do they have an option of the apple in their community? She said. Do they have walkable, safe communities where they can be active? Nelson said the 5210 campaign has moved towards viewing childhood obesity through this lens, looking to influence systems for better health. Grants through the program in recent years have gone towards setting up water filling stations at schools and parks, setting up story walks to encourage physical activity. It really started with looking at the messaging that impacts individual behavior, but it's moved on to more looking at the environments and the systems that can help create healthy communities, Nelson said. These issues pop up in clinical settings as well. Vilani, the pediatrician from Pleasant Hill, often has parents express concern about their child getting enough exercise because they don't have a backyard or there's no convenient way to get activity outside the home. Some families live in a food desert and don't have easy access to fresh produce. Milani said her office asks questions about food insecurity on intake forms, asking whether a family needs help obtaining food or other essentials. We have some health workers that will look at those and then try to help people that are struggling. They might need some extra food, or might need some help with certain social situations, she said. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 25th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Nadine G. Strait. Nadine G. Strait, 88, of Des Moines, formerly of Waterloo, died Sunday, September 4th at the Eden Crest of Beaverdale Assisted Living in Des Moines. She was born September 1st, 1934, in Thompson, Iowa, the daughter of Herman T. and Mildred A. Hunter Helland. She married Gail Ambrosi in 1956, and they later divorced. She married Wilbur Bill Strait, and he preceded her in death in 1997. Nadine was employed as a legal assistant in the late 1950s and 60s. She owned the Cypress Lounge in Cedar Falls in the 1970s. She was a member of the First United Methodist Church in Waterloo. Nadine appreciated beauty in all aspects of life. She was an avid and creative quilter. She designed and sewed exquisite pillows out of antique linens, which she displayed and sold at craft shows. She loved flowers and was a talented gardener. Nadine was involved in politics in her younger years. In 1964, she was a delegate for Barry Goldwater at Iowa Convention. Later, she became a member of the Republican Central Committee in Decatur County, Iowa. In the final years of her life, she became a staunch supporter of the Democratic Party and their candidates. Nadine earnestly hoped a woman would be president one day. She spent many happy hours playing cards and games with her friends in Leon at Bridges Senior Living in Waterloo, and later at Edencrest of Beaverdale, assisted living in Des Moines. She always enjoyed a glass of good Scotch whiskey. Nadine will live on in our hearts and will always be remembered for her fun personality, quick wit, and gentle spirit. Survivors include her daughters, Sue Heatherton of Des Moines, Lynn Webb of Perry, Missouri, and Nan Ambrosi of Waterloo. Three grandchildren, Chris Henderson, Lori Turner, and Claire Heatherington. Nine great-grandchildren, her sister Marilyn Gill of Des Moines. Preceded in death by her parents, her husband, her brothers Chet Helland and Jerry Helland, her sister Carol Timpson, her son-in-law Larry Webb. Memorial service, 11 a.m. on Friday, September 30th at the Hagarty Weichoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street, with interment at Memorial Park Cemetery. Public visitation 1 hour prior to services at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the First United Methodist Church in Waterloo or the Panora Kindred Hospice in Panora, Iowa. Online condolences may be left at www.hagartyweichoffgrarup.com. David E. Lawson. David E. Lawson, 50, of Kent, Ohio, passed away Friday, September 2nd, 2022. Born and raised in Waterloo, Iowa, to Robert E. Lawson and Wanda Lawson, when David left Iowa and moved around until he found his calling in Lubbock, Texas, counseling others and helping them to follow the right path. David became ill after a surgery that left him debilitated and in pain. Due to this medical problem, it led him to be later diagnosed with gastroparesis, an autoimmune disorder, and POTS. He found a hope for a cure in Ohio, where he moved and planned for a future without pain. He fought this disease with help from family, numerous friends, and the gastroparesis community. This community helped each other have faith in their goals to fight and beat the disease. They found David a great person, one they could depend on. David fought for his life, and one that would allow him to be free of pain. Unfortunately, he succumbed to this disease in disorder while living in Ohio. He placed his faith in God and now is living his life whole, pain-free, in peace. Survived by his parents, two siblings, Deborah Lawson Wilson and Lynette Lawson Kerr, four nieces, Kendra Lawson Blanchard, Tabitha Jo Lawson, Emily Kerr, and Kyla Kerr, two great-nieces, Angela Lawson and Regina Blanchard. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, October 1st, 2022, at 2 p.m. at the Central Church of the Nazarene, 901 East Country Club Road, Roswell, New Mexico, 88201. Private burial will be held at the Veteran Cemetery in Roswell, New Mexico. Memorial donations and cards to the family can be mailed to Central Church of the Nazarene, 901 East Country Club Road, Roswell, New Mexico, 88201. Services and care of Bissler & Sons Funeral Home and Crematory, 628 West Main Street, Kent, Ohio, 44240. Dennis Lee Gade. Dennis Lee Gady, 80, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, September 21st, 2022, at his home of cancer. He was born on July 15th, 1942, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Vern and Dorothy Gady. He graduated from Waterloo East High School in 1962 and was a member of the Army National Guard. On November 2nd, 1968, he was united in marriage to Marilyn K. Siller in Waterloo. He was a machinist and inspector at Viking Pump before retiring in 2004 after working there for 36 years. Dennis is survived by his wife, his daughter Denise Braden of Cedar Falls, a son Daniel Gady of Woodbury, Minnesota, four grandchildren Reese and Axel Braden and Cohen and Tessa Gady. He was preceded in death by his parents and two brothers, Larry Gady and Ronald Gady, in infancy. Dennis was a lover of all GM vehicles and kept them in mint condition. He enjoyed spending time with his four special grandchildren. Dennis was a lover of God's green earth and especially enjoyed mowing lawns and pruning trees and bushes. He was a talented man and had the ability to fix just about anything, and was always willing to lend a helpful hand. A memorial service will be 11 a.m. Friday, September 30th, 2022, at Nazareth Lutheran Church in Cedar Falls, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will be at the Garden of Memories Cemetery in Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to the Nazareth Lutheran Church and Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Now let's move over to some sports that happened. Starting with Half Nelson, Half Fiction, Blackhawks Smabby, a Rising Commodity. It is an anomaly in today's coaching world, and particularly at the junior hockey level. The Waterloo Blackhawks were blessed for two decades with the same head coach, P.K. O'Handley, who brought championships to a franchise craving for them, while also spurning offers to either join the college or professional college coaching ranks. That kind of stability in the United States Hockey League is rare. Only in Cedar Rapids, where Mark Carlson is entering his 24th season as head coach and general manager of the Rough Riders, has a coach lasted longer with a USHL franchise than O'Handley. So what's the point here? The Blackhawks themselves, have themselves another good coach in Matt Smabby. The hope for the Blackhawks organization is that Smabby sticks around for several seasons. Yet that is a self-serving sentence, because you get spoiled working with one coach for a long time. Intuition tells me that Waterloo is only going to be able to keep Smabby around for a few seasons. I have no inside information or inkling that Smabby is looking to move on. And by no way am I insinuating it either, but there are obvious signs it could happen. Successful coaches in the USHL, especially in recent years, have earned bigger and better opportunities. You only have to look back in the last decade to find USHL coaches who have advanced to become head coaches of NHL teams. John Cooper, Jim Montgomery, Derek Lalonde, And before he had a highly successful stint at the University of North Dakota, Seattle Kraken head coach David Haxtell, who coached Smabby at UND, was the head coach at Sioux City. There was another sign I got recently. I was with a I was with I was in Grand Forks a couple of weeks ago, where Smabby started or starred as a collegiate player, coached as an assistant for at UND, and ran the Grand Forks youth hockey program before being named Waterloo's coach in July of last year. On two different occasions, while covering Northern Iowa's football game with UND, I was asked not about the Panthers, but rather if I knew Matt Smabby. People in Grand Forks love Matt Smabby. One conversation was with a random Fighting Hawk and Matt Smabby fan. The other was with a UND beat writer who asked me how Smabby was doing before saying the second-year Blackhawks coach stock is rising and other opportunities may have already been presented to Smabby. That was an interesting tidbit. However, I believe that Smabby is completely and fully invested in his current job, which is molding young men not only into future college and professional players, but into better men. He is an amazing coach, somebody you can rely on, Blackhawks second-year forward Garrett Skifski said. An open door every single minute of the day, where you can go in and talk to him about any and everything. He is an open and understandable guy, and I love him. The feeling is Smabby is also on a mission to bring more championships back to Waterloo. In his first season with the Blackhawks, Smabby admits that he had his ups and downs as did his team. But by the end of the season, Smabby had Waterloo playing at a high level, winning a Clark Cup playoff series before falling to the eventual champion Sioux City. A pretty solid season for a first-year head coach. At the same time, Smabby lives by the mantra, "If you're not growing, you are dying." I learned a lot, Smabby said of his first season, like our guys and our team did. I failed a lot. I did a pretty deep assessment on what I did and what I liked, and that I did things and I would change moving forward. For me, going through situations and dealing with players, all of that was a first-time thing. It is an experience to draw back on when things pop up in the future. It was a great learning experience, continued Smabby, talking about season one. You have those expectations of what it is going to be like, and then a heck of a lot of things pop up when you are expecting them to go one way and they go a little bit different way. I'm always sitting back and thinking about in what ways do things get better? Who are we and how we treat people isn't going to change, but we are always going to be looking for ways to get better. The first year was fun, challenging and hard, and I can't wait to get them going again. Those kinds of comments sound like a coach with tunnel vision on the task at hand, until he finishes the challenge to his specifications, he is of the ilk that is not dying, but growing. Now let's go on to some college football with Cyclones can't keep pace with number 17 Baylor. Iowa State coughed up two turnovers. Baylor lost zero. The Cyclones were whistled for a spate of ill-timed penalties on the first and third quarters. The Bears committed just three the entire game. So Saturday's Big 12 season opener for both teams provided ISU with its latest example of how devastating a lack of attention to detail can be, as number 17 Baylor trotted off the field with a 31-24 triumph before an ordinary early before an ornery early but subdued late crowd of 58,064 at Jack Trice Stadium. The world's momentum, Cyclone head coach Matt Campbell said after his team lost a conference home game for the first time since 2019. From my end, we know this is a game of momentum, and you always felt like we were fighting from behind. It felt like that way because it's true, and it lasted all game. ISU safety B.A. Freiler was ejected for targeting with 13 minutes and 6 seconds left in the first quarter. And an unnecessary roughness call on linebacker Corey Reeder compounded the Cyclones' problems while fueling the Bears' game-opening touchdown drive. Campbell erupted on the sideline after the targeting call, as well as a handful of others, including two no calls, while a cascade of boos descended from the stands. "It's unfortunate because I really felt like we came out and played really well, and we were physical," Campbell said. "From my end, and again, that's me, and that's being the coach, and we'll navigate this through the journey, but I don't think those are our right." And again, you work through it and you got through it, but I think it's frustrating. But equally, there are some things we did that were frustrating today too. We need to be better. After ISU tied the score 7-7 on Hunter Decker's 2-yard touchdown pass to tailback Jarrell Brock, Baylor drove for a field goal. The Cyclones' offense went 3-and-out, and the Bears pushed the lead 17-7 on quarterback Blake Chapin's 1-yard touchdown pass to linebacker and fullback former Iowa Hawkeye Dylan Doyle. "I think the game showed we have a lot to fix," Reeder said. "So we've just got to double down and go at it harder. It's not going to get any easier. It's just going to continue to get harder, so the way we respond is really going to define the rest of our season." ISU scored the game's final 10 points via Brock's recovery of his fumble in the end zone. Jace Gilbert's 28-yard field goal with 55 seconds left, but the ensuing onside kick bounced Baylor's way and the Bears ticked off the final seconds in victory formation to leave Ames with a win for the first time since 2016. "We're really going to find out what kind of team we have," said Brock, who rushed 73 yards on 14 carries. "If you let this game define you, we're not going to be any good, but if you let it move us in the right direction, we'll be okay." Deckers completed 23 of 36 passes for 284 yards, 2 touchdowns and 2 interceptions. Xavier Hutchinson caught 8 passes for 84 yards, and Colorado transfer Dimitri Stanley recorded his first career touchdown catch in an ISU uniform. But on the day when the Cyclones need to play with poise and precision, ill-timed mistakes and mental lapses proved impossible to overcome, as usual. "Here at Iowa State, we've learned that you have to make the ball bounce your way," Campbell said. Now on to some more Iowa college football, with the Cats take bite out of Leathernecks. UNI rides pair of big defensive plays to record first win of 2022. Do not test Northern Iowa defensive back Wu Governor. Governor entered the season with no interceptions in his career, but after getting a taste of the addictive feeling 2 weeks ago against North Dakota, he will not leave the season with the same number. A pair of Governor pick sixes helped the Panthers notch their first win of the season, as UNI bludgeoned the Western Illinois Leathernecks 52-17 on the road Saturday. Following the win, Governor described himself as speechless due to his opportunity to flip the game on its head. "I watched a lot of film, big on preparation," Governor said. "Flatter tipped the ball up. I was able to get it. Corby Sander and Jevin Brecky, those guys did a great job of blocking for me. They really made that one happen for the first time. On the second one, I was just able to catch it, and then it was wide open." With a couple of bumps in the road, UNI dominated in all three phases, offense, defense, and special teams, en route to the win. UNI head coach Mark Farley said that he was pleased to see his team get better throughout the game. "It's good to win, but it's good to win on the road," Farley said. "To win on the road, I do not care where you go, it is hard to do." The Panthers' offense continues to struggle with finishing its drives in the first quarter of the game, as UNI saw drives stall at the WIU 44 and 41 and the UNI 41. On their final drive of the first 15 minutes, the Panthers drove the ball to the WIU 33, but a sack cost UNI 8 yards on 3rd and 4, forced Panthers out of field goal range. While its offense spun its wheels, UNI's defense showed shades of recent Panther defenses. The Leathernecks' first drive looked promising as they drove the ball down to the UNI 18. However, on 2nd and 4, WIU quarterback Clay Bruno rolled his right hand and launched a pass over the head of his intended receiver. Senior safety Benny Sapp III intercepted Benny Sapp III intercepted the errant pass in the end zone for a touchback. In the second quarter, the UNI offense fed off of the play and ridded itself of its red zone blues. With 11 minutes and 52 seconds remaining in the half, Theo Day found the senior wide receiver Quan Hampton in the back of the end zone on a 6-yard passing score. WIU managed to respond on the ensuing drive. UNI's defense helped WIU with a face mask penalty on the 2nd and 6 for the UNI 46. With the ball on the UNI 31, the Leathernecks picked up 15 yards in 2 plays to enter the red zone for the second time of the half. But UNI forced 3 consecutive incompletions and WIU settled for a 34-yard field goal. Laramie Mason converted on the attempt and cut UNI's lead to 7-3 with 8 minutes and 13 seconds remaining in the half. Despite the Leathernecks' response, UNI's offense continued to surge in the second quarter as Day continued with Sam Schnee on back-to-back passes for 12 and 17 yards to put UNI fringe of the red zone at the WIU 28. Dom Williams toted the rock on each of the next 6 plays for the Panthers before powering into the end zone from 1 yard out to put UNI on top 14-3. UNI capitalized on a WIU 3-and-out carry, 3-and-out on the following drive, and Matthew Cook drilled a 34-yard field goal with 41 seconds remaining in the half to put UNI ahead 17-3 after 30 minutes of action. The Leathernecks came out of the second half swinging as Bruno found Jaleen Reed on the 4th play and the drive for a 47-yard touchdown pass to cut UNI's lead 17-10. And the company did not wait long to see the response. On 2nd and 12, Day broke loose from a sack attempt and scrambled forward for a gain of 10 yards. On the next play, Day escaped a collapsing pocket, rolled right and found tight end Sergio Morancy for a gain of 12 yards and the first down. Day capped the drive with an 11-yard touchdown pass to Hampton 2 plays later, putting UNI on top 21-10. Senior offensive lineman Eric Sorensen laughed when asked how the offensive line reacted to blocking for a mobile quarterback. "It is awesome because it gets us juiced up," Sorensen said. "When we see Theo break, contain, and rush for 10 yards, it's awesome. He is a pocket passer, so when Theo breaks it, it fires us up." With the outcome of the game uncertain, the UNI defense slammed the door on the Leathernecks as Governor came up with his back-to-back pick sixes. Leading 38-10, UNI forced a turnover on downs at the WIU 42-yard line. Gains of 16 and 15 on consecutive plays gave UNI possession on the WIU 7 to end the third quarter. UNI officially shut the door on the Leathernecks as Day threw for his third touchdown of the game, connecting with Desmond Hutchinson on a 7-yard completion. Leading 45-10, UNI regained possession with 11 minutes and 29 seconds remaining in the game following a WIU punt. Redshirt freshman quarterback Aiden Dunn relieved Day and led a 9-minute 56-second drive capped by a 4-yard touchdown run for Harrison Bay Bui. Farley called the drive an exclamation in confirmation of what UNI wanted to do. Sorensen spoke similarly about the long drive from the offense to put an exclamation point on the win. "That's what the offensive line loves to do," Sorensen said. "We love when we see run. We love to run. We will take advantage of it. We want to run the whole field." After a late WIU touchdown, UNI emerged from their second conference game of the season with a win to improve to a 1-3 on the season. Day finished the game 23-29 for 260 yards and 3 touchdowns with 17 rushing yards. "I want a quarterback to play to win," Farley said. I do not care if he throws for it, runs for it, dives for it, stumbles for it. I do not care. It is how you win. He is throwing the ball to everybody, not just one or two guys. Farley also highlighted Sam Schnee, 4 receptions for 70 yards, and Alex Allen, the three receptions for 53 yards as standouts on offense. Defensively, the Panthers forced 3 turnovers, held the Leathernecks to 102 rushing yards, and came up with 4 sacks. They came out and had to keep getting better, Farley said. They found out what our defense looks like when it is executed in the way that it is. I think they got better as the day went on. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, September 25th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.